Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. In a moment, Robert Mugabe was a goodwill ambassador for the World Health Organization for all of 3 days. We'll hear in a moment why the WHO has suddenly overturned that appointment. Also today, we'll speak to the health minister in Madagascar on a deadly outbreak of plague in the country. Plus, Russia goes after one of its most outspoken critics again.
I received an email from the Department of Homeland Security on Friday alerting me to the fact that my U.S. global entry status had been revoked.
And endangered songbirds.
All the competitors have hung their bird cages. And as soon as the covers come off and all these male birds are side by side in their cages, they start to sing like crazy. So apparently the scoring is for tone, volume and performance.
So could competitions like that one be the secret to saving endangered species? More of that coming up in a few minutes' time. But we start with the news that the World Health Organization has executed what must be one of the quickest U-turns in its history. Just a few days after appointing the Zimbabwean president, Robert Mugabe, as one of its goodwill ambassadors, the head of the WHO announced today that he was going back on that decision after an international outcry. Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus posted a short statement on his Twitter feed. We voiced up part of it.
I have listened carefully to all who have expressed their concerns and heard the different issues that they have raised. I have also consulted with the government of Zimbabwe, and we have concluded that this decision is in the best interests of the World Health Organization. It is my aim to build a worldwide movement for global health. This movement must work for everyone and include everyone. For me, what is important is to build political leadership and create unity around bringing health to all based on WHO's core values. I remain firmly committed to working with all countries and their leaders to ensure that everyone has access to the healthcare they need.
Well, the Southern African director at the campaign group Human Rights Watch, Dewa Mavinga, welcomed the change of heart but said the WHO head needed to accept responsibility for his mistake.
That is the sensible thing to do, because there was really shock and outrage that the World Health Organization could do such an embarrassing thing as to name Mugabe a goodwill ambassador when he is presiding over a collapsed public health sector. The Director General of the WHO fell short because he did not acknowledge the mistake that had been made. He should say it was a wrong decision, it should not have been made, but it is good that it has now been rescinded.
So how embarrassing is this for the WHO? Here's our Africa correspondent, Andrew Harding.
Well, it's been very badly handled, clearly. So yes, egg on face all round, and a humiliation, of course, for President Mugabe too. I think if one tries to put oneself in the mind of Dr. Tedros, the first African to head the WHO, from his perspective, I mean, he has worked for many years in Ethiopia's government, so he's from an authoritarian background, if you like, and presumably to him, President Mugabe was not this monster that so many talk about in the West. Instead, he was an elder statesman on the continent, a man who loves to travel around to summits and UN events, and somebody who presumably could have access to and influence over some other, perhaps more old-fashioned or authoritarian leaders on the continent, so could get a message about healthcare, about fighting cancer, to places that other goodwill ambassadors might not necessarily be able to reach.
And yet, the fact that the appointment was made and there was outrage from many quarters suggests a lack of political nous at best, perhaps, whatever the good intention.
That's certainly one interpretation. I mean, clearly, Dr. Tedros would have known that there would be a huge backlash. Perhaps he miscalculated the speed and scale of it. I suspect he did. After all, this is a humiliation for him. On the other hand, he may also have wanted to send something of a political message to the rest of the world, or to the West in particular, to say, well, look, we will appoint who we like. We have got to solve Africa's problems, and that means dealing with leaders of all sorts and shapes and sizes and political views. So we're going to make the appointments on this continent that we want to. We won't be dictated to by the views or the prejudices of other governments.
Has there been any reaction from Mr. Mugabe or anyone in his government?
Not directly. I phoned around quite a few people. Most of them didn't want to speak. One senior figure in ZANU-PF, in Mr. Mugabe's party, concurred that this was a humiliation, but felt very strongly that this was another indication of the West trying to bully Zimbabwe, to bully Africa. I mean, that's very much the anti-colonial line, of course, that ZANU-PF has taken for some time. And I think it's one that we will hear more of in the days ahead.
Just finally, I'm thinking about health provision in Zimbabwe. I mean, is there any doubt that throughout, what, more than three decades of Mr. Mugabe's rule, that health services have been significantly degraded in that time?
Well, if you go way back to the 80s and the early 90s, Zimbabwe was a, you know, an African success story. And President Mugabe's government, education system in particular, and the health system were among the finest on the continent. Since then, it has been a story of mismanagement, political chaos, and systemic collapse of the economy and of the health system. And when you talk to ordinary Zimbabweans now, people complain about unable to access the most basic healthcare, of people dying of the most preventable diseases, of a health system in absolute crisis. And of course, they have watched for many years President Mugabe, in sharp contrast, jumping onto planes to fly to Singapore and elsewhere for his own healthcare.
Andrew Harding speaking to me from Johannesburg. And we did ask the WHO for an interview with Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, the Secretary General, but we're told that he wasn't available this evening. Now, the trade in wild birds in Indonesia is threatening to drive many species to extinction. That's according to the International Union for the Conservation of Nature and Bird Life. Zoos and conservation organisations around the world have now come together in an effort to prevent dozens of species of songbirds from being lost to the trade in what's seen as an example of man-made mass extinction. The BBC science reporter Victoria Gill has been to the forests of Java in Indonesia to investigate.
We're about halfway up a forest mountain, a protected area in West Java. It looks like very good sort of bird habitat, but actually it's very, very quiet. There's very little bird song. This is just showing me how you make a bird trap out of just some sticks from the trees around us and a piece of string. Our guide here is Uas, who knows this forest inside out because it's where he made his living, hunting and trapping birds.
I hunted any birds that lived in this forest, from the smallest to the biggest.
Uas caught birds only when he needed the money. But while he now works in conservation, as a ranger here, networks of trappers operate across Java, clearing forests of birds. That's why there's one place you're guaranteed to see thousands of them.
This is Pramuka Market. It is the largest wildlife market in Asia, possibly in the world, and it is crammed to the gills with caged birds. Just auditory sort and senses is incredible. It's a very, very noisy place.
They'll just catch everything, and everything ends up here in the market.
I'm here with Andrew Owen from Chester Zoo, a bird conservationist of three decades who's here as part of an international mission to save 19 species of songbird now driven to the brink of extinction by the trade.
You have all these different elements. You have the singing competitions and the birds that are used for show. And it's the species that are being harvested from the wild in vast numbers. They're the ones that we're most concerned about.
Bird shows and singing competitions are part of a bitter cultural irony of the destruction that's caused by this trade, because the demand is driven by a national passion for songbirds.
This is the sound of a bird singing competition. All the competitors have hung their bird cages. And as soon as the covers come off and all these male birds are side by side in their cages, they start to sing like crazy. So apparently the scoring is for tone, volume and performance. And the judges are just walking around with their score sheets now. Meanwhile, the bird owners are trying to encourage their own birds to sing louder and better.
Very important.
Right. Yeah. So to be a true man, you need a house, a wife, horses, a weapon, and a bird.
And a bird.
Right.
Then you are real Javanese.
Then you are a real Javanese man. Okay.
My host today is Tony Sumam Pao. He's a wealthy zoo owner and conservationist who's encouraging the bird lovers of Java to leave the wild populations alone.
And all the birds in this competition are captive bred. Yes. Is that what you would like to see to maintain the birds in the wild?
Yes, I think that's very important to educate all the bird lovers that they have to use the captive bred birds for the competition.
The birds in the wild can be protected then?
Yes, yes.
There's no doubt that everyone here loves songbirds, but the trade in wild-caught birds has now reached such a tipping point that the only way conservationists can save some species is by bringing them into captivity to breed.
We're at Chickenanga Wildlife Refuge up here in the mountains of West Java. Hidden away in the forest is an aviary with some of the most critically endangered birds on the planet. Listen to these guys.
Yeah, these noisy characters are Sumatran laughing thrushes.
Right.
Very apt indeed, yes. So this one's a young Javan green magpie that's bred here at Chickenanga. One of many Indonesian species that are really threatened by this songbird crisis. You know, this vivid apple green colour and this black sort of bandit's mask.
This is one of the rarest birds on the planet. I mean, how many of these are left in the wild?
What we do know is there's 60 in conservation breeding situations, so 60 on the planet as far as we know,
right.
Plus a handful possibly in the wild.
What would you really hope to see?
I'd like to see in the next sort of 4 or 5 years a fully established population of these birds safe in captivity and working to get these birds back into the wild in safe environments where there's no threat of further trapping. They fit perfectly into the web of life in the forest.
Wonderful sounds of the forests of Java in Indonesia. That was our science reporter, Victoria Gill, there. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Still to come on the programme, why Ethiopian musicians in exile are now heading home.
Some of the older musicians from the 1970s were working with a younger generation, and those younger musicians trained in the West and moved back to Ethiopia. So now it really feels like Addis Ababa is as vibrant musically as maybe it ever was.
More on that coming up in about 20 minutes' time. Let's just recap our main headlines from the newsroom this hour. The World Health Organization has reversed its decision to appoint the Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe as a goodwill ambassador following an international outcry. And the American Secretary of State says Iranian-backed militias who've been fighting IS in Iraq should now go home. This is James Menendez with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, Bill Browder is a prominent businessman, born in the US but now a British citizen, who's been leading an international campaign against Russia, a mafia state, in his words. At the root of the campaign is the death in custody of one of his lawyers in Russia, Sergei Magnitsky, back in 2009. Magnitsky was jailed when he investigated claims that Russian officials stole more than $200 million in taxes paid by one of Mr. Browder's companies. Well, since then, he has persuaded the US Congress to pass the Magnitsky Act, targeting Russian officials accused of human rights abuses. And now this week, the Canadian Parliament has passed similar legislation. Well, on Friday, Bill Browder discovered that he'd been placed on the Interpol wanted list by Russia. I asked him how he'd found out.
I received an email from the Department of Homeland Security on Friday alerting me to the fact that my U.S. global entry status had been revoked. And I'd had a similar experience with U.S. authorities in the summer this year after testifying at the Senate Judiciary Committee, where my visa was revoked in relation to an Interpol arrest warrant. So then this week I contacted some law enforcement contacts that I had who confirmed that as of the 17th of October, Russia and Vladimir Putin had put me on the Interpol list.
Just explain to us, what does the global entry status mean? Does that mean you can just travel around on your passport?
Global entry is a U.S. thing, which is basically a fast track that you can sign up for, which allows you to get through security faster.
What do you think's led up to this? I mean, do you think it is directly related to Canada passing its own Magnitsky Act, or is that just a coincidence?
Definitely not a coincidence. So you have to look back in history. This will now be the fifth time that Russia has tried to add me to the Interpol list. The first time was after the U.S. passed the Magnitsky Act. The U.S. had passed the Magnitsky Act in December of 2012, and then in May of 2013, Putin tried to get me on the Interpol list for the first time. That was rejected by Interpol. They tried again in July of 2013. That was then rejected again. They tried again in 2014. They tried again last summer, and then they've tried again now when the Canadians passed the Magnitsky Act. And I can point out that on Thursday night, Vladimir Putin gave a speech in which he devoted about 5 minutes of the speech to his anger about the Canadian Magnitsky Act and his anger about me. So it's all completely related. There's no question. And Interpol has come to that conclusion a number of times before.
That it's politically motivated.
Correct.
And is that what's going to happen this time? I mean, what's the process for challenging it?
Well, as soon as we learned about it, we wrote to the General Secretary of Interpol saying that this is outrageous and that they should get rid of this. But the problem here is that Interpol has already made a decision a number of times that they're not going to entertain Putin's political vendettas outside of Russia. But the problem here is that Russia has access to their system, and they can effectively, without any interference from anybody, send out a worldwide notice called a diffusion notice, which means that I'll be arrested at any border point I cross. And so Interpol is now in a situation where they're being used by criminal gangsters to go after their victims. And for a crime-fighting organization to basically be used by the mafia is an outrage beyond belief.
And what in the immediate term is the effect on you? I mean, you have to stay put, presumably.
Yeah, any border that I cross, I'll be arrested. And it's not as if the guys in these brown uniforms with their badges at the border are going to be knowing about the history of this case. They'll arrest me, and then I'll have to spend time, money, and energy trying to be getting free.
If the Russian government were here, I'm sure they would say they're just trying to follow judicial process, and they're using this to enable that to happen and to bring you to justice. What do you think Russia wants?
Well, Russia wants to get me back to Russia, put me in jail, and then kill me like they killed Sergei Magnitsky, my lawyer, who they did the same thing to. That's their objective. They've stated it very clearly. This is not about judicial process. This is about a political vendetta in which Sergei Magnitsky and I have exposed a massive Putin-related crime, and he wants to silence us. He silenced Sergei, and he wants to silence me.
This is never going to end, is it?
Well, I think this will end when Vladimir Putin is either democratically deposed, overthrown, or whatever else happens.
Have you had anything back from Interpol on this yet?
No, we just wrote to them on Friday, so I'm sure that their phones will be ringing on Monday morning from various people, including British lawmakers who are outraged by this whole incident.
Bill Browder. Well, Interpol can issue what's called a red notice or a diffusion notice. The second merely says that an arrest may be requested. Listening to that interview was Rutsal Martha, a former director of legal affairs at Interpol. Does he think that a diffusion notice is the case here?
My impression is that this was a diffusion, and probably it was a diffusion for a different offence than the offences for which previously a red notice has been refused.
Because a red notice requires another country to make the arrest immediately, is that right?
Yes, a red notice essentially is a request by Interpol to all its member states to arrest the person and to make this person available to the country that is looking for him. and that would then trigger the extradition procedure. Its purpose is to restrict the mobility of the person concerned so that he can be processed through a extradition proceeding.
But the diffusion, can that lead to arrest? Because in Mr. Browder's mind, the fact that Russia put this out, and that's indeed what it was, he assumes that means that, you know, he can't travel and that he risks arrest.
From the Interpol's perspective, Interpol does not expect its member countries to arrest him, but the practice learns that many countries do not make a distinction between red notice and a diffusion. Very often that leads to a situation where people are detained at airports and because the requesting country is not yet ready to ask for extradition, then the person has to be let go.
And in terms of challenging that, whose responsibility is it? Is it the individuals concerned? Is it their responsibility to say to Interpol, look, you know, what's going on here, and make a legal challenge? Or how does it work?
Yes, Interpol has a procedure, a kind of a court, and individuals concerned can file a complaint with their chambers and challenge the intervention. It doesn't have to be a red notice in order for an individual to challenge it. An individual who is aware that even a message has been sent, and if he has good reasons for that, he can challenge that too.
How has this happened again? I mean, Bill Browder says this isn't the first time. It's happened several times, and each time it's been dismissed as being politically motivated. So how can a country then keep doing it? Do they have to keep presenting new information each time?
Yes, it has to concern each time a different offence. Being in a police organisation, Interpol operates on the principle of the presumption of accuracy and relevance of requests coming from a member state. So police, in first instance, trust the words of another police body asking for assistance. On that basis, the system kicks in immediately, trying to help the country that is seeking for assistance. But in second instance, once the individual concerned becomes aware of the issue, he can challenge that and raise the necessary doubts that can lead to a cancellation. And that is most of the time the case with diffusions. When it comes to red notices, on the other hand, the rules require the General Secretariat to scrutinize a request and subject them to a legal review. So that may explain why in the past the requests for red notices have been rejected, because maybe the requests didn't comply with the conditions or were involved activities prohibited by Interpol's constitutions. But in this instance, if indeed it is only a diffusion, diffusions are not subject to legal review, and consequently only when the individual becomes aware of it afterwards he can challenge it.
And that was Rutsel Mathur, a former Director of Legal Affairs and General Counsel at Interpol. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. Stay with us. We've got a lot more to come in the next half hour of the programme. You're listening to a podcast edition of NewsHour, available twice every day straight after the live edition of the programme. If you're enjoying this, then why not take a look at other podcasts from the BBC World Service? The Inquiry, one topical question tackled by four expert witnesses. Or The Conversation, every week two women from two cultures talk about the passion or experience they have in common. Coming up in a moment on NewsHour, we'll head to Madagascar. But first, the war of words between the Catalan government and Spain's central government in Madrid continues, with both sides accusing each other of carrying out a coup d'etat. On Saturday, Madrid announced it was starting the process of taking over the functions of the regional administration in response to the recent push for independence. That amounts to a coup, says the Catalan leadership. Not true, said the Spanish foreign minister to the BBC Today. So to what extent are views hardening on both sides of this controversial issue? Our correspondent Tom Burridge has been gauging opinion on the streets of Spain, starting at a pro-independence rally in Barcelona.
So Madrid has made its move. But a large part of Catalan society out on the streets tonight, campaigning for independence, will not take it lying down. The key test for the Spanish government will be when it tries to physically take control in the coming days of Catalonia's devolved government. For those out on the streets, peaceful direct action will be the order of the day.
I feel so sad about this. This is not a democracy. I feel that we are living in a dictatorship.
It's been many years that we tried to talk with the government, but it's like they're only looking for Spain.
What you guys ultimately want still is a recognized referendum, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is Plaza España, Spain Square, in the city of Zaragoza in Aragon. Locals here are enjoying a sun-soaked, long Spanish lunch. In places like this across Spain, there is no shortage of support for the Spanish government's position vis-a-vis Catalonia. People here are willing their government to act. Luis Falcón guides us into his bar full of Spanish police memorabilia. This former Spanish soldier says Madrid should have intervened in Catalonia long ago.
No.
And on the Catalan topic, Berta has it crystal clear. The independents lot are doing what they want, she tells us, but they can't.
Disculpa, buenos días, señores.
Then a father and daughter visiting Zaragoza.
De qué parte?
De Barcelona.
Yes, next door, in Catalonia. Marie Pilar says she is very Spanish and Catalan, but in her village, it's a divisive topic which many avoid.
Yo vivo en un pueblo muy pequeño. Y no se puede
hablar. Mass inside Zaragoza's vast basilica, a world away from cosmopolitan neighborhoods in Barcelona. Two Spains and people divided about how Catalonia fits in.
And that was Tom Burridge reporting there from Spain. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. This is the BBC World Service. I'm James Menendez and you are listening to NewsHour. Let's head to Madagascar now in the Indian Ocean. There's been a deadly outbreak of plague there which has already killed nearly 100 people and infected many times that number. Plague is endemic on the island. There are cases every year, but usually the less serious bubonic form transmitted from animals to humans. Well, this outbreak has been passed from human to human as pneumonic plague. And it's far more dangerous. I've been speaking to Madagascar's health minister, Mami Lalatiana Andrimanarivo. How serious is this outbreak?
Every year we have cases of plague. But this year we can say that it is more serious because we have plague in two towns of Madagascar, in Antananarivo and in Tamatav. And it is the first time that we have pneumonic plague in these areas.
So pneumonic plague, and that is the form of plague that is transmitted from human to human.
Yes.
So how are you dealing with this?
You know, it's I can say that it's not easy, but we take a lot of decision to fight the epidemic, and with our partner, as WHO, UNICEF, USAID, we are working together to stop the epidemic.
And what is the priority when you have an outbreak like this? How do you isolate it and stop it spreading further?
Our priority is now that to do contact tracing of the cases. To do that, we put health control in the roads to control people, because the problem is that people continue to move.
Is there also a problem with stigma of plague? I've been reading that often it's difficult to trace cases because people disappear, they go into hiding.
Yes, it is the most problem in our country, because for people in general, plague is not good for the society. People don't like to have this disease, and they prefer to not go into the hospital, for example. They are afraid because for them, they are shame.
Madagascar's Health Minister, Mami Lala Tiana Andry Manarivo, speaking to me a little earlier. Well, Dr. Peter Small is a medical doctor currently running the Stony Brook Global Health Institute in New York. The college has been working continuously in Madagascar for nearly 30 years. Welcome to NewsHour. Dr. Small, why does Madagascar have plague every year? Isn't it possible to eradicate it?
Well, there's actually nothing surprising about this disease of antiquity killing poor people, because there is an incredible power for poverty to turn back the clock of progress. Madagascar is one of the poorest countries in the world. And despite their best efforts, they simply don't have the public health system that we have in richer countries. And so when you have a bacteria that is endemic, it becomes much more difficult to control.
How much more serious, I mentioned the two types of plague, bubonic and pneumonic, how much more serious is pneumonic plague to humans?
Well, they're both pretty nasty. If you get bit by an infected flea, you develop these big pus-draining abscesses or buboes. And without treatment, many of those people will die. But if you inhale the bacteria, you develop a rapidly progressive pneumonia, which is uniformly fatal without treatment in a matter of days. And even more concerning is that it's transmitted person to person through the air. So, you know, pneumonic plague in a city can spread quite rapidly. And that's really where they got unlucky this year. They have both cases in the big capital city, and they are being spread through the air.
And in the case of this year's outbreak, is that just one of those things? There's not much you can do about it.
Yeah, well, fortunately, there's a lot you can do about it. You know, it's a entirely treatable disease, and the world has scrambled a really important response, and it's gratifying to see. It's why it's important that we have the WHO and other international organizations, because this can and will be stopped.
It will be stopped. I mean, but how many more people might die before that it is brought under control?
Yeah, I'm not very good at predicting the future. I can tell you that it looks as though, from the data that I've seen, as though the numbers are starting to drop. And in general, plague is not flu. Flu can whip around the globe in a matter of days to weeks. This is a disease which is likely to be confined to the country of Madagascar with good public health measures and lots of international support. They'll get it under control, and I think the country will be back to normal and in time for people to enjoy a good winter vacation there.
In other words, people shouldn't be at the moment, well, perhaps they should at the moment, but in the future, they shouldn't be scared to visit.
No, this will pass, and the country will get back to business. And I think with all of these epidemics, the big question is, will we as a global, will humanity see this as a reason to finally invest to prevent it from happening next year?
Thank you very much indeed. That was Peter Small, Dr. Peter Small of the Stony Brook Global Health Institute in New York. Now, the Ethiopian economy is booming, investment is flooding in, and many expats are returning. This growing prosperity means the capital, Addis Ababa, is attracting musicians and artists as well as the construction firms. Ethiopian jazz has a unique style. It's taken elements from Ethiopian folk music, Orthodox church music, American jazz, to name just a few. Well, much of that style was developed outside Ethiopia by musicians who fled the country into exile in the 1980s. Well, they've influenced bands like Debo Band, which is based in Boston in the US. We've been speaking to some of the members of the band, starting with saxophonist Danny Monkonen and violinist Katha Hostetter.
In the 1980s, you found a lot of Ethiopians leaving, so you've started to have kind of a brain drain or talent drain from Ethiopia. And probably in the last 10 years or so, the top producers of Ethiopian music who were sort of centered around Washington, D.C., moved back to Ethiopia and I think are beginning to create a revitalized scene there. Some of the older musicians from the 1970s were working with a younger generation, and those younger musicians trained in the West and moved back to Ethiopia. So now it really feels like Addis Ababa is as vibrant musically as maybe it ever was.
When I first came to Ethiopia, I was approached all the time by people who were saying, I love violin, I'd love for my daughter to play violin, or my son, or I used to play violin, or there's a sort of like an old memory of the instrument, but it wasn't really present there. So I started collecting instruments, and I've collected now over 100 violins, and I think 20 cellos or something. I'm trying to establish a school, combining Western technique and more familiar Ethiopian scales and melodies.
My name is Mari Abe and I play the accordion. I'm also a trained ethnomusicologist and I teach ethnomusicology at Boston University. But I think it clicked with me particularly, this Ethiopian jazz music, more so than other genres that I play on the accordion, partly because it has this really uncanny resemblance to Japanese pop music called Enka. And I was born and raised in Tokyo. And so there's this really strange familiarity that drew me to this music. And on the latest album, I actually tried to mix up Okinawan folk music and Ethiopian pop music, because they use the same scale, but it's not just that similarity. There's other sort of sensibilities, and especially for Okinawans, they went through a lot of difficulties, famine, war. A lot of people migrated and created diasporas abroad, so I thought maybe we could do musical and sort of social commentary parallels. So I translated Okinawan lyrics to English, and then Brooke then took inspiration from the original lyrics and then wrote new songs, new lyrics in Amharic.
Based on what she told me, I wrote a song that's also tied in with, you know, the Ethiopians who live outside of Ethiopia. There are many of them, you know, in Boston, D.C., and et cetera, and all over the world. They feel a sense of attachment to the country, that there's some melancholy about their past and their youth in the country. So it's about how we're emotionally attached to this land.
That was some of the members of the Debo band, based in Boston in the US, now returning to Ethiopia. Let me just recap our main headlines this hour. The World Health Organization has reversed its decision to appoint the Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe as a goodwill ambassador following an international outcry. And the American Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has said Iranian-backed militias who've been fighting the Islamic State group in Iraq should go home now that the battle is drawing to a close. Mr. Tillerson, who's visiting the Middle East, said all foreign fighters should leave and allow the Iraqi people to rebuild their lives. He was speaking in Qatar's capital, Doha. He stressed that the US wanted Kurds to stay united within Iraq to continue to fight the Islamic State group. And he assured Kurds that any unfulfilled expectations or rights they were promised in the constitution would be addressed in time.
Prime Minister Abadi has, I think, made it clear his commitment to follow through on those constitutional obligations. And we hope the Kurds will engage with Baghdad in a very productive way to see that the Constitution is fully implemented. I think many of the Kurds' concerns will be addressed through that process. So we encourage the parties to not escalate the situation, not lead to conflict, and stay coordinated and not forget that the war to defeat Daesh is not yet over, and that remains the greatest threat to Iraq.
That was the U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson speaking in Qatar. We're going to be hearing from Iraqi Kurdistan and the areas around it a little later in the programme, in about 7 minutes' time. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. Do stay with us. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. One of the ways that so-called Islamic State was able to transform itself from an insurgency into something akin to a government was its ability to raise revenue from taxes and from oil, from the oil fields that it captured from the Syrian government 3 years ago. Today, though, as it loses territory everywhere, it's now lost control of the country's largest oil field. American-backed forces, the SDF, say they've recaptured the Omar field in Deir ez-Zor province in the east. Ghadi Sari is managing partner of Governance House, a Middle East risk consultancy. Is that what he's hearing too?
It is accurate. In fact, the SDF has managed to control this field while the Syrian army was stopped 3 kilometers away from the Al Omar oil field in Syria, which means that they've actually beaten the Syrian army to it.
Right, so it was a bit of a race for control, was it?
And it's been ongoing for a while. This race for areas to recapture from ISIS has been going on between the Syrian army and the US-backed SDF forces.
And what does it mean then for the future of the oil field that the SDF are now in control of it? Presumably the Syrian government wants to get its hands on it. I mean, that's why they've been fighting for it. But I guess they won't be able to now.
It's not really the time for that question yet, because while a lot of territory is being captured in Syria, it's not clear yet how territories will be handed out in the end, because capturing something militarily does not necessarily mean you get to keep it if a settlement happens or if a conflict happens between the two parties. So for the moment, we're just aware that ISIS has lost control of that territory, which is great. It cuts the funding to ISIS. But at the same time, it's very soon for the Kurds to start extracting the oil themselves and selling it.
Presumably the Syrian government at some point will be making a pretty strong case to take back control of all of Syria's oil production, and obviously in order to reap the benefits from that.
The Syrian government actually wants to control all of Syria, as President Assad have constantly repeated. So for them, this adds to the many, many oil fields that the SDF controls. And not just, it's not the first time that the SDF controls a strategic facility in Syria. So we know that the Syrian government is very interested in getting its hands on this field. But is it willing to go to conflict with the SDF? That is the real question. And we don't think that this is in itself a reason for them to start fighting.
And is the assumption that this oil field will still be productive? Islamic State have set oil fields alight before when they've had to retreat, but they didn't do it this time, it seems.
The so-called Islamic State is no longer what it used to be. They've just lost Raqqa, which is a bigger loss for them than the oil field. And the means that ISIS extracted oil from these fields was very primitive, but whereas these fields are capable of producing at an industrial scale. So at the moment, none of this is going to be used by either side, because first of all, you've got conflict all around that area. The whole area is under a de facto siege. So imagining how that oil will make its way back to the market is a different question than how ISIS was using it, which was on a very local scale.
But the basic point is that IS has lost territory and it's lost its means of funding itself.
And I think that is the story today. While it is true that there is a proper race between the SDF and the Syrian regime for territory, that the real story is that ISIS is losing once again on another day another of its important means of finance and stability, which is the policy that the international coalition has agreed on, but also countries in the West, countries in the region. This is, in fact, a positive outcome to the war against ISIS, but also in itself a reason for worry for later as different parties race for the territory to capture.
Ghadi Sari of the risk consultancy Governance House. Well, from Syria, let's move across the border to Iraq, which is also dealing with the aftermath of the fight against so-called Islamic State. As the common enemy largely disappears, so those who've been fighting IS have now turned on each other. There have been skirmishes between Kurdish fighters and Iraqi government troops near the oil-rich city of Kirkuk. Today, the US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson urged both sides to sit down and talk. Tension has risen sharply in the wake of the independence referendum held in Iraq's autonomous Kurdish areas last month. Well, the BBC's Richard Galpin is there. He sent us this report.
The fighting, which erupted on Friday morning, was intense. Kurdish fighters known as the Peshmerga exchanging artillery and machine gun fire with the Iraqi armed forces. There were many casualties. the Peshmerga was soon pushed back further away from the key city of Kirkuk. Another gain for the Iraqi federal forces, which has spent the past week retaking territory which had been in Kurdish hands. A big blow for the Kurds' long-cherished dream of an independent state. Particularly as the oil fields in Kirkuk province are now also back under central government control. We visited one of the biggest fields, Bay Hassan, and watched as Iraqi troops waved the national flag jubilantly from a high building.
How significant is this for the Iraqi government to have control of this area again?
Captain Feras told me the oil fields in this region belonged to Iraq, not Kurdistan. It was a good thing, he said, they were now once again in the hands of the government in Baghdad. For the Kurds living in their capital, Erbil, and the other Kurdish areas of northern Iraq, it's been a very sudden reversal of fortune.
So I've come to the old historic part of the city here, and I want to gauge opinion amongst people here about their view on the referendum now, given everything that has happened since then.
Khalid Abdullah, a money changer at the market, believes independence has once again become a distant dream and blames the Kurdish leadership.
The referendum was a good idea, but we didn't listen to Europe and other countries when they said do not go ahead with it. And we didn't think that as a result of failing to listen to them, those countries would then not help when the Iraqi army started fighting us.
But in a tea shop across the road filled with men playing backgammon, I found a very different response from a lawyer called Masroud.
This is not the first time they've fought the Kurds. The Shiite militia cannot live with the Sunni and Kurdish people, and the Kurds cannot live with the Shia and the militias. And the Iraqi government is using the referendum as a justification for this war, but the referendum is the voice of the people.
There is now a concerted effort to get the two sides to negotiate, not least by the international community. The stakes are high. Without talks, there could easily be another major flare-up in fighting.
That was the BBC's Richard Galpin reporting there from northern Iraq. That is it for this edition of NewsHour from me and the rest of the team here in London. Thanks for listening. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Bye-bye.
NewsHour has been a download from the BBC. To discover more and our terms of use, visit bbc.com/podcasts.